The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hey, everybody. My name's Dan DeLuca, and I'm from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I'm here to introduce tonight's heavyweight double bill of not one, but two of the most compelling comic artists of our day. That would be Daniel Klaus, who's the creator of, among other works, The Great Eight Ball, which was really my introduction to alt comics back in the early 90s. And which gave birth to Ghost World, which I'm sure, as you know, was turned into a movie directed by Terry Zwigoff, which Furch Klaus was nominated for an Academy Award. His new book is Mr. Wonderful, which I'm sure you all have or will have by the end of the night, which tells the touching story of an eventful night in lives of a lonely guy on a blind date with what seems to be a too-good-to-be-true girl. It was originally serialized in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and you'll be hearing more about that very shortly. And along with Dan, we've got Ben Ketcher, who's a dazzlingly original artist of whom Michael Chabon, if I'm pronouncing his name right, said is the creator of the last great American comic strip. I'm not sure which of Ketcher's strips he was referring to at the time. It could have been The Jew of New York or Julius Knipple, real estate photographer, or it might have been this one, The Cardboard Valise, which is the basis of Ben's first new book in 10 years. And it's a strip about an imaginary land of humane hamburger stands and restroom ruins. And it also comes with its own valise handles, which is very cool. It's a visual aid. Anyway, along with Dan and Ben are both going to talk about their new books and show slides. And for the second part of the show, well, and actually throughout, they'll be accompanied by Chip Kidd, who's an editor, novelist, book designer, longtime champion of both of these guys' works, and their editor at Pantheon Books. And he'll ask some of his and some of your questions. So please, everybody, turn off your cell phones or at least turn the ringers off, and please refrain from taking pictures. And welcome to the stage, Dan Klaus, Ben Ketcher, and Chip Kidd.
Hello, everyone. My name is Chip. We are thrilled that you are here. To my right is Mr. Dan Klaus.
Hello.
And to my left is Mr. Ben Ketcher. And I feel very honored to be between them. We are going to do a presentation with Dan. I'm an editor and designer of graphic novels at Pantheon Books in New York, and we are extremely honored and proud to have published their two new books that are out this spring. Dan's is called Mr. Wonderful, and Ben's is called The Cardboard Valise. And so we're going to talk about Dan's book, we're going to talk about Ben's book, and then we're going to do Q&A. So here we go, and I'm just going to show some images from Dan's book, and he's going to talk about them. This is the front cover.
Yes.
Yellow.
I didn't really have anything prepared to say about this, actually.
Okay.
That was just sort of the placeholder image.
Okay. So, now, as some of you may or may not know, this book has origins in the New York Times, but what we're going to talk about first is just a a short,
concise. I sort of just put these in to acclimate people to my world so that they could get the full experience. They could be grounded in my my oeuvre. This was my first comic in, my first successful comic, let's say, in 1989, back when there were roughly, I'd say, 3,500 weirdos who read these kind of alternative comics. And I like the contrast between this and being in the New York Times Magazine, because back in these days, our comics could only be found in the, you'd go into a comic book store, and there'd be like a cardboard box in the back that said adult. And that's where our comics would be. And it would be like with like unicorn pornography and like just like the weirdest, creepiest stuff. So you could never like, you know, have a new girlfriend and their parents would say, oh, what do you do for a living? You could never say like, well, you take three buses out to like this really bad neighborhood and you go in the comic store and you go in this, in the back room and there's a box that says adult and you'll find it there. So, you know, this is our humble beginnings. I don't know if we need to go through all. I don't have a little story for each one of these.
That's okay. I think just developing the idea of the sensibility of these compared to then what you eventually did for Mr. Wonderful. And, of course, this is, you know, the seminal art school Confidential that anybody who's ever been to art school, I'm sure at this point, practically has tattooed their thighs. How long were you out of school before you did this?
Well, let's see, this would have been about 1991, so I would have been out of school 7 years. Well, I remember actually, because it was when my student loans came due. That was when I actually didn't understand about student loans. I thought, like, my parents just sort of talked me into getting a student loan, and I thought, I didn't even know what a loan was. I thought it was, like, free money, and I didn't know you had to pay it back, actually. And then one day I got this bill for $7,000, which may as well have been $700 million. And I just thought, I had to pay for that? Really? I thought there was some kind of deal where I didn't have to pay.
I'm sure I asked you this before, but you went to Pratt.
I did.
In Brooklyn, which is what this was based on, correct?
I guess I can say that, yeah.
Did you ever regret going there?
I mean, so I regretted that I didn't get more out of it. You know, that I should have gone, you know, for a short time and kind of moved on quicker, but
where do you think you would have moved on?
I don't know. I should have just maybe started drawing comics on my own and saved my money. I think that would have, because I really learned everything that I now use on my own just by trial and error.
Did they encourage you or teach you comics there at the time?
No. They every teacher would say, when you get over this phase of doing these comics, I think you might do good work at some point. But this, you know, this Betty and Veronica stuff, that's what they'd always say.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's changed, though, hasn't it?
I believe so. I mean, now there are colleges that teach, you know, sequential arts.
Oh, yes.
And stuff like that. You know, it's a big, big business.
Yeah. And have they invited you back to, like, the Mr. Famous alumni?
Absolutely not. It's
You're
interesting.
Kidding.
No, it's interesting. No, there was actually a few years ago, I get the magazine because they obviously want me to donate money. And in the magazine, there was an article about, like, famous Pratt alumni who work in comics. And it literally got down to, like, a guy who was a colorist for Image Comics who had just graduated and had colored, like, 5 comics. And I thought, really? That guy and not me?
And not you.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, no, they're still bitter.
Their development in office needs to get up to speed. All right. This is the cover of the collected Velvet Glove, I believe.
I'm just trying to get a quick plug for all my books, right?
Why not? And caricature. This is certainly one of your most beloved stories, caricature.
I don't know, maybe. I don't know. I can't tell. Nobody ever says anything to me.
And, of course, this one. what really surprised me about this, and the correct pronunciation is,
it's actually pussy.
I thought.
No, I had I drew an image where he's saying it's pronounced pousse.
Exactly.
But that's not how I pronounce it.
So it was like the, yeah. The Sean Connery pousse.
Yeah. I was on an NPR call-in radio show, and somebody called in and asked about this book, and so I was talking about it on, you know, like Talk of the Nation. I was going, "Well, when I did Pussy," surprised they didn't just like bleep out the entire.
What really surprised me about this was, I mean, I see you as somebody who is really sort of like above all the mainstream.
Oh no.
Comics world, and the insight into at the time Image Comics was.
Really, I did this before Image Comics. I didn't really even know much about that.
And yet, that
I just predicted it basically.
It's terrifying the way you presaged
this. This came from, you know, when I first started doing comics like 8-Ball, they would, you know, there'd be local comic conventions in town, and so I thought, well, that's my one place to sell these comics, and I would go and just sit there, and it was the most fruitless endeavor. You just sit there and watch your books collect dust while the guy next to you had, you know, Dan Pussy had a line around the block, you know, of 14-year-old zit-covered boys. And it's hard to imagine I was jealous of that, but I that's what this came out of. I was very bitter about the whole thing.
Has anybody come forward and said that they were the person that Pussy was based on?
Actually, I talked to a couple of people who were the sort of the physical basis, and they were like, yeah, there's a lot of guys like that in comics, a lot of those nerds. You know, they're never aware that it's them.
And then the, I think, great breakthrough, would you say so?
Certainly the one I've sold the most of.
How long did you work on Ghost World?
Couple of years, 3 years maybe. But, you know, I would do an 8-page chapter every issue of my comic, so it was very piecemeal. So this, I was trying to, when I was putting together the slideshow, I was trying to come up with an image that was an image for the film of Ghost World, just, you know, to throw that into my body of work. And this was, when we finished the film, they hired some art directors to put together an ad campaign for the film. And this was one of the poster designs they came up with. Life is for losers, Ghost World, bite it. He's really captured the feeling of the film.
It's like, so who did do this drawing?
Some, you know, production artist. That's supposed to be Steve Buscemi on the right. Like, did they even get that he's not playing a teenager in this film? They think, like, that's weird casting. He's a little old to play high school, you know, Reggie in high school or whatever.
And, of course, the one on the left then became the ScarJo.
Yeah, that really looks like her, doesn't it?
Unbelievable.
The Thora Birch looks like a blow-up sex doll in the middle.
Like, how many different poster designs would they have done for this?
I have a book of ones equally great as this one. hundreds and hundreds.
Huzzah.
Now finally, Pantheon gets into the act.
Yes. Now, we were very thrilled to publish David Boring. And this had come about at a time in the late 90s where basically, I've been a lifelong comics fan, but when I was first got my job at Knopf, which is also Pantheon was part of, in 1986, we were just, Pantheon was preparing to publish something called Mouse by Art Spiegelman, and which I had been reading in serial form in college, and I was just sort of, you know, watching this all from the sidelines, and I was very, very excited. And it became what it became. And so then that gave Art Spiegelman a platform to publish a lot of the artists that he was publishing in what was Raw Magazine, which were Mark Beyer and Charles Burns and Gary Panter. And so there was this window of about 4 or 5 years where Pantheon was doing this. And then there was a big regime change at the publisher. And mostly through the 90s, then after that, nothing happened. And then I forget what year it was that The Jew of New York came out. He doesn't remember. This compatriot, my main compatriot at Pantheon is this editor who I answered to, a wonderful guy named Dan Frank, and he calls me up one day and he says, you know, I got this book proposal in by this cartoonist named Ben Catcher. And do you know who this is? And I said, well, I do very much know who he is. I follow him quite closely in the New York press and elsewhere, and I think he's great. And he said, well, we've got this book proposal. Why don't you come up and take a look at it? And I did. And he said, what do you think? And I said, well, are we going to do this again? And he said, I don't know. Should we? And I said, well, I think we should. And I think we should do this. And there are these two other guys I know. One is Chris Ware, and he's got a book that he's been working on for 10 years called Jimmy Corrigan, and it's almost done. And then there's this guy, Dan Clowes, who has this book that he's been working on called David Boring, and I think we should do that too. And so Ben's book came out first. It was called The Jew of New York. And then in 2000, we did David Boring and Jimmy Corrigan, and it was a very sort of exciting reemergence of Pantheon doing this kind of work. And so for us, this was our first Dan production, and this then became the second.
Right.
And the design of this is based on?
Based on, you mean stolen from those old Charles Schulz Peanuts paperbacks that came out in the 60s. He used to do this kind of oblong format for collecting the old Sunday strips, and so I just basically copied it, used the same colors. I scanned the colors on my childhood copy that had this perfect faded quality and tried to replicate it exactly. And here's, so, this is last year,
this came
epic.
Out about exactly a year ago.
Yes, right? Yes. This is another book about an angry middle-aged guy living in Oakland.
Right.
But he lives on a different street than the guy in Mr. Wonderful.
So
it's completely apartment. Different. It's like basically I go on a dog walk every day, which is the only time I leave the house, and half the time I go in one direction, which is where he lives, and then the other half of the time I go the other direction, which is where Mr. Wonderful takes place. So now I'm out of places. I have to like do an outer space story or something.
Now, this, I think, took a lot of people by surprise because this was the first, and correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't this the first thing you did that had not been previously serialized anywhere?
Yeah, I gave up on the comics.
Right, but you didn't.
On the comic books I gave up on, yes, on the little staddled stitched pamphlets. There was just a certain point where you got the sense that nobody wanted you to do those. You know, like bookstores are like, we don't carry those, and comic stores said, those are too cheap, we don't make any money, and publishers said, please don't do comics. And finally, I started, you know, I spent like a year trying to figure out what I was going to do, and then I just realized I actually don't need to do those anymore. I kind of got it out of my system.
Yes, and so, no regrets about that.
No. I feel like, you know, now we need to really focus on books, and books are, comics, we're an endangered species, and they're already pretty much dead. And now we have to put our last, you know, ounces of energy into making nice books while they're still around.
And we'll, of course, we'll get to this later, but let's get to it now. Did this come out as an ebook?
No, okay. I don't. I'm not opposed to that, but it's nobody's come up with a technology to make it look good enough that I've seen. You know, maybe they will, or maybe they have, and I don't know about it, but I want it to look right on the screen if it's going to be in that format.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to that with Ben, yeah. Because that was an issue that we got to with him.
I just put this in because I figure anybody over over 60 or anybody who is my parents. This is the only way they know my work.
So let's see. These are about a year apart, and they're actually in opposite order.
Yes, I was trying to make a comment on the regression of our... No, forget it.
So on the left, we have the useless PhD, and he's going to be living at his parents' house.
Yeah, my wife had just gotten her PhD, and that's basically... She didn't move into her parents' house, but, you know, close enough.
And on the right, this was for a special issue of The New Yorker on...
It's like the innovators issue. I just like the idea of this old hippie who's flying around New York.
Finally figured out the jetpack.
With the guy, I kind of pushed it a little with the guy in his office with a little iPod dock. That's the, you know, I had to look up the most boring lamp I could find to get that little table lamp.
And when, obviously when you're doing something like this, it's a very sort of different thing than doing your own book covers for your own books. And how many permutations of these ideas do you have to go through or present to The New Yorker, to the art director?
You know, I've been pretty lucky with these. I mean, I did another version of the PhD guy where he's applying for a job at a taxi driving job, and he's at like the taxi garage, and he's humbly handing the guy the PhD, and he has that look of an old New Yorker character, like I tried to draw him there, where his eyes are closed proudly, and she liked this one better, and then with this one, I just had another one where there was a guy looking out an airplane window and sees that guy fly by. That was, you know, I'm sure as an art director you know this, or maybe you don't, maybe I shouldn't tell you this, but illustrators always have an idea that they want to do, and then they do two bad ones, and they turn those in, so they turn in three, and art directors almost always pick one of the bad ones. Yeah, like the worst, like the one you think, like, I'll just do this in 5 minutes. And
it's in our job description.
Yeah.
Like, don't pick the good one.
Right.
Pick the shitty one.
And it's almost like you have to, like when they pick the bad one, then you have to go like, oh, no, you pick the bad one. And you have to talk them into the good one.
That's like when, by the way, when I'm doing a cover for something, I send them one thing.
There you go. I didn't know you could do that.
you can try and get away with it.
Yeah.
Usually what I do is if it's a novel, I'll send them a cover design, but I'll leave the phrase a novel off of it.
Right.
So it's just the title and then the artwork or whatever, and then they... author's name. So I send that in. They're like, we really like this, but should we say a novel?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they feel like they can bring something to the project.
There are tricks like that with screenwriters, know tricks like that to write a really superfluous scene, a really clearly superfluous scene in a film. And keep it in the script, and then the producer will have something to cut out, and you go, no, I love that scene, that's my baby, I'm going to fight, you know, and then you finally relent, and they feel like they've done something.
Did you do that with Ghost World?
Maybe.
Okay.
Now, back to the current day.
Now back to the current book. I will say... I mean, nobody, I guess, who doesn't follow these sort of things would know, but for the second week in a row, Mr. Wonderful is number one on the New York Times graphic novel bestseller list.
It wasn't, number two was like Green Lantern, you know, Strange Destiny or something. It was some book I had never heard of.
Brightest Day.
Oh, sorry.
Hello. Please. But it's true. Yeah, no, it's interesting. You get these New York Times bestsellers in-house. I mean, and, you know, they don't even publish the graphic novel one. I guess they probably do it on their website, but they don't do it in the actual New York Times.
No, I didn't realize that, and I was, like, looking through the book review, like, where's the graphic novel list? You know, and they have everything. They have, like, you know, children's books for 12 to 14-year-olds, you know.
Advice and how-to for right. really pathetic people. Right. And, no. But it is hilarious, the hardcover graphic novel list. Like, every now and then, like, something really genuinely great will be on it, and then everything else is like movie tie-ins.
Well, and also like Watchmen is always like number always three, on. Yeah.
That's because it's the War and Peace.
I guess so.
Okay, so...
I didn't do this, by the way.
Right. You put this one on. This is Chris Ware.
Just to show what, you know, this was the feature that Mr. Wonderful first appeared in the New York Times Magazine, and they had a feature called the Funny Pages, which was an ill-conceived idea the entire feature consisted of one page of comics, a continued story every week, and a continued fiction piece, and it's like you can't create a section with two pieces. It's like there's no pattern, you know, it's a dyad. It's not enough to give any impression of what it was. And none of the comics or fiction pieces were funny.
No, they had nothing to do with being funny.
So it was like they were mocking the reader or something. You know, it's, if you don't find this funny, you're an idiot. Or, you know, it was very hard to figure out what they were going for. But anyway, it was, you know, they were publishing these great cartoonists in weekly installments, and so it seemed like a great thing to do.
I have to admit, I mean, reading your thing week to week, Mr. Wonderful, I thought it was great, and.
But you were the one. You were the one guy who read it. I mean, I didn't read it.
Oh, come on! But I think
this. I put this in because this was. This was several years before Mr. Wonderful, and this was an article about male pattern baldness in the. This was like on the, you know, the contents page. It was an article about, you know, those 45-year-old kids and their graphic novels, and after this came out the Sunday this came out, I was just like walking my dog, and it was actually in L.A., not where I live at all, and. People were recognizing me all over the street. People were like slowing down their car. I saw you in the magazine today. Wow. And I've never had that for anything, ever. And I thought, wow, this magazine is a big deal. I thought, maybe this is like a magazine people actually read. You know, it's like when you're in something like Entertainment Weekly or one of those magazines, you realize, like, nobody reads this. You know, like, that's a magazine. It's in a dentist's office, but nobody reads it. Nobody's ever gone, oh, I saw you in Entertainment Weekly. That never would happen. But this was a magazine people actually read. So I had this thought of doing sort of a popular comic strip, you know, something for a broader audience. And that was something I'd never conceived of doing before.
Had you ever done a weekly strip before?
No, never. Never anything even remotely like that.
Oh, wait.
I put this in because I assumed that when I first talked to the art director, she was very, very cautious, and she said, I really would like you to consider the audience. And I assumed that she had Googled my work and this was the first thing that had come up. And so yes, I've got a very mainstream idea about a grown man who wears his underpants all day. And
I love Pogey Babe. I wanted to date him.
Yeah. Could be arranged.
I mean, how good would a Pogey Bay cartoon be in the New York Times?
I know, I should have done it.
Dream. Okay.
So this is going to be a strange photo to have up as I tell this story, but as I was talking to the woman, I started to think about what she said about, you know, consider the audience, and I thought, she's just talking away, and I'm talking to her, and I'm not even listening to what I'm saying, but I'm thinking, you know, I only do work for an audience that is just sort of an imagined duplicate of myself. Like, I don't think about who's reading it, because I don't really have any sense of that at all. But I started to think, if I'm going to do something for this kind of mainstream thing, I can't do it for an imagined mass audience. I don't want to sort of spread the work out and make it unspecific. So I thought, I have to have a specific audience member in mind. So I thought of just the quintessential reader of the Sunday New York Times. And for some reason, it popped into my head as Errol Morris, the filmmaker. I don't know. He just seems like a guy who'd still read the print version of the New York Times. And so that I was sort of stuck with that as the thought of the reader. And then she said something about...
And did you worked with him on something, didn't you?
I did. He did an Apple commercial that was never aired that I was in, but we don't need to talk about that. But
it's
Googleable, I believe. But so she was, you know, she was talking about, you know, how I needed to make this, you know, sort of audience friendly. And so I jokingly said, like, how about I do like a romantic comedy, you know, and I meant it in the, you know, sort of sub Ashton Kutcher, Sandra Bullock terms, you know, just like I was making a joke. It was, you know, just that's something I would never do in a million years. But then as I was talking further, I started to think, like, that's actually a really good idea. I could do a romantic. And then I started to think, what if this imagined reader of the New York Times Magazine is also my protagonist? And so I'm directing it exactly to the person that I'm writing it for. And so there we are. So I'm writing this for Errol Morris. So I did these sketches very quickly. On the right, he's basically an adult Charlie Brown. And on the left, he's sort of tweaked a little till we get the actual guy. It was very quick. This is all like the morning of this telephone call. I was working on a completely different project, a big graphic novel that I was hating. I just wasn't enjoying, and it wasn't working out. And
can you tell us which one?
I never did it. I threw it away. But you know, I got this call at like 10 in the morning, and by 2 in the afternoon, I had done these sketches, and by, you know, 5, I was already, you know, I'd plotted out the whole thing practically. It was just, you know, sort of all came in that phone call. So I started looking, I was thinking, you know, it's a romantic comedy. I started looking at old romance comics. You know, these are just, you know, typical 50s romance comics. And I thought I'd like to do something in that vein. And I noticed that they were always, it's always first love, first date, first kiss. Because these, you know, these are done for 12-year-old girls, and they're about to have that experience, and it's a way they can sort of live through the, you know, the experience without actually, you know, having gone through it yet. It's a way to sort of practice this. So it's all about firsts. And I thought what would be more dramatic and more interesting to me would be to do the last date. You know, it's this is his last chance. You know, he's like, he hasn't been on a date in many years, and he can just barely summon up the gumption to go on this one date, and if it doesn't work out perfectly, like, that's it. You know, he's just, you know. So,
I loved what you did here with, and I don't think it was the first time, but where somebody starts to say something, and then you're overlapping it with what then he is thinking.
Well, I was trying to think I had to sort of think about what are the facts of this specific story that I have to deal with, and one of them was it's going to be in the New York Times Magazine, so it's going to be censored, you know, and I've never been censored at all, you know, and so I never had to think about that, and I thought, here, you know, this guy is going to be constrained by just being in this magazine, so I decided to make him a sort of pure superego. He's a self-censoring character, so he's all about constricting and censoring himself. And so I wanted it to be where he's not even able, not only is he interrupting what other people are saying, but he often interrupts what he himself is saying. And, you know, he's completely living inside his head. This was, there were actually several times where the New York Times did censor me, and one time was this panel where I used the word schmuck, and she called me. I turned it in, and it went through all the editors and everything, and then, like, the day before it was about to go to press, she called me up and said, yeah, you're not going to be able to use schmuck. And I thought, what schmuck? And she said, yeah, it's a vulgar, you know, Yiddish term. And I said, yeah, but they can say it on SpongeBob SquarePants. You know, I'd literally seen that. Like, my son had been watching that. And And she said, yeah, you know, you're not, I don't think so. And so I have a friend who's a researcher, and I said, can you help me out on this? You know, there's got to be a way I can talk them out of this. Because it's really, it's the only word you can use to get across a certain type of character like this in one balloon. And a friend of mine went on the New York Times archive and found a William Sapphire column from the New York Times magazine that said, you know, the word schmuck is now a toothless word that's, you know, can be used in common parlance. And, you know, it was exactly what I would, and I sent that in. I said, here it is from the pages of your own magazine. And they, yeah, you just can't use it.
Get out of here.
Yeah, no.
No
so,
way.
So I had to white it out. So it's just in the printed version. It just says, what are you doing? It's very toothless. And the other thing they wouldn't, in the early strips, the character Marshall says Jesus occasionally as, you know, a little expletive. And then about five strips in, she called me up and she said, you know, it's so funny. We got a letter from a lady in Arkansas, and she really objects to your use of the word Jesus, and she's going to cancel her subscription. I thought, oh, that's great. You know, I thought that's what we need. We need, you know, put that in the letters page. Let's get, you know, I need controversy. And she's like, yeah, we're not going to do that. And yeah, you can't use the word Jesus anymore. And I thought, like, so if I write like a letter to, you know, David Brooks and say, like, can you wear funny glasses in your photo? You know, it's like they call him up and like, now the reader wrote in, you have to wear funny glasses in your photo.
Pathetic.
Yeah,
that's
so
pathetic.
They were, the editors were really on my side, really backing me up. So
anyway, for anybody who doesn't know, the premise of this is a blind date. And with a somewhat older man, somewhat younger woman, and he spends the first part of it wondering if she's even going to show up. And she does, and she seems, frankly, too good to be true. And as the night goes on, he comes to understand that she is too good to be true. And it sort of, it goes on from there. And it's, but it's a, I mean, it's hard not to use the cliches of the fact that this book totally lives up to its name. And it's also what was fascinating to me as a designer and a fan and an editor to see what Dan did to expand it into what really does feel like a full-length book as opposed to a series of weekly strips.
Well, I mean, in the original strips, you know, I had the element of time. You know, so I tried to do cliffhanger endings,
yes,
to each strip.
Which worked beautifully.
Well, except nobody actually read the strip in the magazine, so it had no effect at all. But you know, the idea being, you don't see the girl's face, and you have a whole week to think, what's she going to look like? You know, and I imagine people around the water cooler going, I can't imagine what Marshall's date is going to look like. And then, can't wait for Sunday to see what happens. And so when doing the book, I had lost that element of time. You know, I couldn't put in a little title card in between each strip saying, you know, please wait 1 week before reading next strip. The thing I did have was plenty of space, you know, the story was very constricted as it was told, you know, having 20 episodes with one page a week to try to tell a somewhat substantial story is you're fighting for every square inch, you know, you're putting in every little word balloon you can to try to tell the story. And so to do it in book form, I love the idea of this kind of cinema scope world that I could create, you know, and kind of open it up to see where they're situated and give it this kind of this atmosphere that you don't have in the just the strip version.
So the reviews have been great, but the consensus seems to be, this is really the nicest, sweetest thing he's ever done.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that bother you?
No, because I mean, that was sort of the intent, was to do it. This is the only book I've ever done, as I said, you know, for a sort of an imagined audience. So, and you know, I felt a real connection to the guy as I was working on the story, and I had no idea what the ending was going to be. I'm not going to give it away, but I really didn't know till the week I had to do it. You know, it was like,
really?
You know, 10 days before it was being printed, that all came sort of spontaneously. So
was it like Schultz? Did the characters tell you what was going to happen?
Not so much up to the end. I had sort of control over them till the very end, and then that very last moment came very naturally. So I'm glad people like it.
Yes. Terrific. Well, that is a little bit about Mr.
Oops.
Wonderful.
Dan. Seen behind the curtain now.
So now we are going to turn things over to Mr. Ben Catcher. His new book is The Cardboard Valise, and which somewhat defies description. And you, Ben, you've been working on this for how long?
It was a weekly strip that ran for a couple of years, I think. I worked on it for, but not every minute of every day. I mean, you know, it was a weekly thing. And then I put it away, and I sort of had lost interest in book publishing. I don't know. I was doing other things, theater, and I don't know why. But then I realized that this book had a lot to do with people understanding or being attracted to foreign cultures through print. And I remember when I was a child, if you picked up a book from Russia, it smelled different than an American book. I mean, every country had their own print technology. Hmm. And I thought, well, now that's like a... That hadn't occurred to me that that was part of this story. And then as I saw print culture heading into this possible decline, I said, this is maybe a good time to do a book, put out a book about this. So that became, in a strange way, a more central part of the book. So that, I just had to wait. Some books, you know, are topical and then they become completely dated, and this one had to wait to become topical. That's all. I waited. So anyway, it's so I'll just read a few stories, so maybe save you the having to. These are stories that are self-contained, little one-page stories from the...
Do you know how to...
Yeah, sure. And this first one is called The Baby Monkey Doll. You can read along in some of them. There's no expiration date stamped on their buttocks. It's not something we care to publicize. But in fact, all of these plastic baby dolls have a limited shelf life. Within 10 to 12 years or the duration of a childhood, the petroleum resin base dries out, causing the flesh to become brittle. But this latest shipment of baby Monkey dolls is withering on the vine, an error on the part of an intoxicated worker at the filamentary plastics plant in Jumparopa rendered 2,000 gallons of flesh-colored polystyrene magma chemically unstable. Within 6 months, the dolls begin to wrinkle and shrink in stature, an unintentional mimicry of the degenerative processes of human aging. But why recall 100,000 perfectly good dolls? It's a harmless chemical reaction. And what do children know of gerontology? The ice cream sculpture on Tencent Island. On Tencent Island, ice cream cone licking has been raised to a sophisticated form of art. At this time of day, the boardwalk becomes his studio. The most celebrated practitioner is Cherub Galliot, a short, muscular 40-year-old man who lives in a prefabricated villa on the island's Louche West Coast. There he is, the one in the emerald green pajama bottoms. The sculpting of these abstract forms is traditionally done in the blazing afternoon sun. He has only minutes in which to take a few bold licks, and then it's all over. Spectators try not to make a show of their avid interest. He's the best we have. They know that in other parts of the world, this art form is dismissed as mere child's play. Good, isn't he? Shall I put something in his hat? At the end of each exhibition, the finished cone is tossed into the nearest trash can. Come on, let's go. I wouldn't mind some ice cream myself. Tourists ask, why can't these explorations of pure form be made in a more permanent medium, such as cheese or egg custard? Please, Elijah, you're making a fool of yourself. The artists answer, because such materials cannot be easily modeled with the tongue, the most sensitive tool known to man. A vanilla for me and chocolate for my friend. The professional adolescent. For the past 6 years, the success of the Pantula Trading Company depended upon one man. 7,000 cases of First Kiss antiseptic pads. How should I know? Get me Yuri Madel on the phone. Oh, wow, I love First Kiss antiseptic pads, but only in tangerine and mallow pink. 52-year-old Yuri Madel had the unerring ability to assume the mindset of a 14-year-old child and thus anticipate the material desires and buying patterns of 50 million teenagers. Monday through Wednesday, he's a girl. Thursday through Friday, a boy. He can turn it on and off like a faucet. Oh, wow. He allowed himself to be swept up by the latest cultural trends, regardless of their vulgarity. I really wanted to see the new Johnny Sepsis film, but Yuri, we have dinner plans for tonight. He became a fragile vessel of hormonal yearnings, unformed taste, and violent mood swings. I don't want to eat. I'm going home. So complete was his identification with his subject that he developed a case of acne. It's playing tonight at the Genuplex 4 at 7:30 and 9:30. His infatuation with a certain 18-year-old movie star eventually drove his wife to sue him for divorce. I'm sorry, he's out again tonight with his friends. In the end, the effort required to relive the adolescence of both sexes was too much for the weakened heart of a 52-year-old man. Ticket holders only, please. The fortune cookie debunker.
I wouldn't even read it. I don't
know. Stop. Two or three times a week, Frederick Dungeon invites a group of unenlightened friends to join him for dinner at a Chinese restaurant. After you, please. He orders strictly by number. Beef chow fun, soy sauce chicken, number 39, and eats whatever he served with evident joy. Can anyone here identify this vegetable? But at the end of the meal, when the check is brought and the fortune cookies passed around, he grows morose. Upon hearing the first cookie cracked open, He flies into a rage of righteous indignation. I'll bet you have an important business development shaping up, or your happiness is intertwined with your outlook on life. What rubbish. He forces each person to read their fortune out loud and systematically debunks each one. You will always be surrounded by true friends. Please, that's idiotic. Wait until you're confined to a public nursing home. You can get away with anything if you print it on a little slip of paper and then stuff it inside of a cookie. No one has the guts to say they're all lies, barefaced lies. Nice way to end a meal. So have a piece of orange instead. Of course, no one believes these fortunes. They just like to read them. It's a quaint custom, and that's the danger.
Very cool.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. So we have a couple questions from the audience that I'm going to read. We don't have a ton of time left. We will, the gentleman will be signing out in the main hall. And any questions we don't get to then, you can ask then. So we're going to do two for Dan, two for Ben, and one for both. I mean, let's get the one for both over with now, because it's inevitably the first question that anybody ever asks. Is the internet ruining comics? Will we ever see an this is actually an interesting question. Will we ever see an alternative comics silver age?
What does that mean?
I don't know.
As opposed to the golden age?
Or is it the electronic age?
How does it go?
There was already a golden age of our generation. Now another will there be?
So
another
I see. So a silver age is the next generation. I see.
Yes.
That's right. Not for we're not smart enough to know the answer to that.
No, we're not. But I mean, internet comics. Do we care? Do you look at them? Is there anybody doing anything interesting?
I just don't like to read comics on the internet for some reason. Just it's a personal thing, and there are old comics that I've been looking for 35 years that are available on the internet, and I still just I skip over it. It's like there's better things to look at than comics somehow. Mm-hmm. But I think it's that's just me. I certainly don't impose that on anybody else. It's just if you were to print out your comics on the internet and send them to me in a little mini comic, I would read it. And if you send me a link, I would never, ever look at it. I mean to, and I just never get around to it.
Oh, yeah. I look at a lot of comics that are distributed, online. There's a great site out of Berlin called Electro Comics that's just, it's just fascinating things from all over the world. The thing is, the monopoly of publishing has been broken. The newspapers and book publishers, and that had a lot to do with them being able to make money out of this kind of work. So there may be a silver age, another generation, but it was really hard to make a living with all of this business in place, and now it's not in place, so I think it'll be harder unless something comes up, charity more.
Charity.
I don't know. It's
comics welfare is.
Well, yeah, some kind of subsidized.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a consensus that we're kind of waiting for the technology to catch up to make it better?
That's always the consent. I mean, that's how it feels, that there's always something around the corner that's going to be like, we'll make a fortune and it'll be, this golden age of web comics or what, and it's just, I don't know. I'm barely just figured out how to make a decent book,
Exactly.
I can't go on to the next phase yet.
Right. I feel the
maybe when I'm in my 80s.
Well, I think repurposing books to electronic forms might be a sort of seem like a pointless thing to do, but I think some people will be inventing picture stories that are somewhere between a comic and a movie and a peep show,
it'll work on the internet. Yeah.
And it'll be different. It wouldn't be, it's not a repurposed. Putting a print book, you know, on an iPad where you pretend to turn pages seems like not too exciting.
It's like a film strip.
It's better for the world not to pumping out all this
stuff. Yeah, but comics are not meant to be thrown away the way some
people threw them away.
Yeah, it depends. I throw away a lot of comics. Who has the space?
You give them
away
to your church.
Oh, yes.
Well,
same difference.
Electronic file, since it's immaterial, there's nothing to throw away. Just erase, delete it, and there's no garbage.
They're taking up server space.
Ben, this is kind of a cliched question, but I don't recall hearing your answer to it. What are your earliest childhood influences in art, illustration, and design?
I guess Sunday comic sections I saw when I was very little, and comic books, the corner candy store. So museums was something I discovered later, and nothing to do with painting. I remember seeing a man painting in the botanical gardens in Brooklyn when I was a child, and I thought this was the most ridiculous thing you could do, sit in a garden, sort of putting paint on a piece of canvas in response to a garden. So I didn't have any feeling, understanding of art in that sense. I just comics and, I didn't understand painting.
Did you study drawing in cartoon?
Yeah, but that's much later. I mean, you're asking my earliest.
Right, yes.
Yeah, it was comic books in the newspaper.
Any specific ones?
You know, this papers like the Daily News had Dick Tracy and Little Orphan Annie. They were still done by the original artists when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And the Daily Mirror, there was even a sort of sleazier tabloid that had our boarding house, Major Hoople. And I thought these were incredibly interesting, more interesting than comic books. I remember comics seemed a little bit like sanitized versions of these things. Less interesting. I know the texture was just not there. So, but that's there was no high art in my neighborhood or in my apartment where I lived. That's later I discovered that at an art school, the Brooklyn Museum Art School, when I was a kid. But,
that's where you went to college?
No, that's where I went. I took drawing classes as a teenager. So then I discovered European art. And then I realized, I just saw the bigger picture and how comics, the idea of text and image was sort of pushed out of painting. And so I always had that feeling from that childhood experience that the tradition that interested me was, from theater to comics to movies, that kind of where you have both things happening, text and image. But that's how it happened.
Mr. Clowes, if you're not commissioned to do a project, are you still driven to pursue personal work?
Well, none of my books have ever been commissioned. Except for Mr. Wonderful, it's probably the only one. I mean, I did Wilson without telling anybody about it and just finished it and then told people, oh, yeah, I did this graphic novel.
So your work is your personal work.
Yeah, yeah. Any of the comic stuff, pretty much with the exception of Mr. Wonderful, is all, I don't tell anybody about it till it's pretty far along, and my wife doesn't even really read it. I'm working on a thing right now that's kind of a longer graphic novel that literally nobody has seen any piece of, so I'm going to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. You do a lot of work in the film industry.
Sometimes. Not always.
I know there was a fear with the great success of Ghost World that you were going to leave comics altogether and go to film altogether. And happily, at least happily for your fans, that has not happened.
Working in film is fun and it's sort of a hobby, but it's comics is what I do. That's my job and that's what I really enjoy doing, and that's I do it every day.
You do?
Yeah. I actually have a very, the schedule of an insurance salesman. Like, I work from, 9 to 11 on screenwriting stuff, and then I work the rest of the day on comics.
Really?
And I really stop, it's 11, time to walk over to my drawing board.
Is this the Wallace Stevens School of cartoons?
Yes. Or I guess Roy Lichtenstein used to work, 9 to 5 and take an hour lunch break.
Yeah, but Wallace Stevens literally worked for Hartford Insurance. During
right, that. Yeah, right. No, I haven't gone that far. Nobody would hire me to do something that important.
Ben, this is a very specific question, and actually I want to know too, because Ben has started for the past, 10 years? Doing these musical theater pieces, which are truly extraordinary. And just wonderful. And the last one was the Kocek...
A Kocek romance.
The Kocek romance, which had a very conventional plot. It was about a gentleman who wanted to build a Kocek room in his apartment and then did so. and then, of course, all sorts of interesting situations ensue. And you work with a gentleman named Mark Mulcahy.
Yes.
And the question is, are you planning to do another opera with him?
Yes, it's been commissioned and it'll premiere in October at the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, and then at Lincoln Center, two nights in each place. So it's about the New York Public Library, actually. It's called Up from the Stacks. It's about a page who delivers books, down in the stacks of the library, circa 1970. So, they commission these things. They give us just enough money to make them. They're not expensive things to do. The production is more expensive. I'm getting everybody to come together and rehearse and stuff like that. But, it's not that different than making a comic strip, except I do collaborate with this this man who can sing the words that I write. And, it's amazing. He has some kind of thing that he's done before he wrote operas. He always said he would sing things in his house, to his wife sometimes. He loved to hear human speech just raised to song, and it comes very natural to him. So that's why I think they work out somehow. But he's a great pop musician from, he had a whole other career, but now he's in music theater. So October, it's not planned to come here, but it might. We did the Rosenbach Company. That's Philadelphia story. That's they're legends in Philadelphia.
That was great. Oh my God. It was in two acts and there was an intermission. And at the cliffhanger ending of act one was
he's carrying a valise, a big, heavy, more like a trunk, filled with these Elizabethan books that he brought back from England. And he's crossing train station.
Folio of Shakespeare?
Yeah, there's incredibly rare stuff in this trunk. And he's crossing a open outdoor train station. And the porter drops these books on the tracks as the train is approaching. it's a story he told. It's a true story. And that's where
the end of Act One.
I think you're about to see this destruction. No, but anyway, I won't tell you what happens. But
I will. I mean, I feel compelled to. It was so funny. Then the beginning of Act Two was hysterical. Very good. Very funny. Wonderful. Mr. Klaus, this is something that I would ask you.
Uh-oh.
Did you have a favorite superhero as a child? Do you have one now?
It's a little personal of a question, I think.
I think so.
I liked Spider-Man, I suppose. You know, I notice, this is pure comic nerdery, but I notice there are people who like Jack Kirby and there are people who like Steve Ditko, and I was always a Ditko person and still am, and I think it defines your personality in some way. I love Jack Kirby, the way it looks and the drawing, and I think it's, you know, it's bombastic and interesting and beautiful, but I don't connect with it at all, and I do connect with the kind of introverted, creepy, urban, you know, isolation of Ditko, and so.
Well, and I think that you can see that in your work.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely, you know, have copied Ditko water towers many times,
yeah.
So, yeah. So that, you know, I would say Spider-Man as a child and as an adult, that's tough. I'd have to go with Green Arrow. I just literally not thought of Green Arrow in like,
right,
you know, 40 years. Does Green Arrow still have the little pointy beard? And
does,
yeah,
indeed.
Cool. All right, I'm going to stick with that then.
So everybody tweet that. Dan Klaus is totally in the Green Arrow. And on that note, I think we're going to wrap things up here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.